Roman Holter, Reel 2.
That once the new priest came to Hodej, things became very much better for us, for the Jewish community. And he was fairly friendly with some of the Jewish people, to an extent that when my father was importing coal and he had to pay before the coal became unloaded, and the railway station was about 6 kilometers away, sometimes my father didn't have enough cash. So my mother would go and to the priest and he would lend her the money. He belonged to one of the richest people in the town, and he had a beautiful house with a large garden. And that was quite exceptional compared with the priest who was there before. None of the Jewish boys would ever venture to go into a church. First, this was not something that a Jewish boy would do. And we felt that that would be considered an invasion of a church by a Jew, which would not be welcome. It's quite strange when one thinks that now people travel and go to St. Peter's and all the churches and admire the works of art. So I only knew the churches, both the Protestant church, which was by for the Poles who were Germans, and Poles who were Christians, simply from outside. And by the churches, one could judge the hierarchy of the place. The Polish church, the church for Polish Christians, had the same spire of the same height as the Poles who were Protestants. And these two spires dominated the town. So you had two spires almost in a straight direction like that next to the market square. And in the middle of the market square was the statue of Kościuszko, the great hero of Poland. The synagogue was modest. It had an outer wall and then had an inner compound with a wooden synagogue. And in addition, just the precaution, it had metal grills. They were so beautiful that the community, Jewish community, decided to put them on the inside, not outside. And one of the people in the Jewish community there was a glazier, and he used to carry the glass on his back and walk from village to village. He was a big, enormous fellow, terribly strong, and this whole contraption which he carried on his back to do glazing must have weighed, I don't know, 100 weight or more. And he undertook to glaze when certain windows were smashed by catapults from outside. And it was assumed that this would be done from time to time. And the grills from inside were never put outside. And they were really lovely. And I used to love sitting inside the synagogue and watch the ladies and watch the grills and watch the lovely bima carved wood. And to me, that was a sense of security, sense of well-being. And hear that lovely singing of, and think that perhaps next year my voice would be right so I can participate. Our family were not musical. On my mother's side, my aunt, who also lived in town, and she was married to the man who was the conductor of the Fire Brigade Orchestra. And he was a very pedantic musician. And they had a child who was my cousin, who was 2 years younger. So, in 36, when I was reaching 9 and he was 7, and he started school, he was extremely bright, and he played chess beautifully, and he played instruments. And I could never understand it. I was older than him, and I could never beat him. He gave me a castle as a start, and sometimes a queen, and he still beat me. So this puzzled me why that was so. I, being older, always protected him when he started school from the other boys who were attacking him, because he was physically not developed, but he was a lovely fellow. And I managed to get, after the war, a photograph from my aunt who lived in Switzerland of my sister, who was 6 years my senior, standing in the middle, and I and this cousin Michon wearing velvet short trousers, standing on either side of her, I being taller than him. And that was a very dear photograph. Just simply to tell you of the lack of prosperity in our town, the four families who were fairly well off were the corn dealer, Jewish corn dealer, the man who had an ironmonger shop. He was very pious. He allowed his children to look after the shop. He went next to the synagogue. There was a place called Shtibel for studying of Torah, and he would go there after breakfast and sit there most of the day and simply study. But all his children were very clever, and he had many of them. And one of the daughter attended the same class as I, Nadja, and she belonged to the group who always received the highest marks in the Polish school. We are graded from 5 down. I was in a sort of group that received 3s or 3+, and she always came at the very end of the year with 5s. And my parents once at lunchtime, when I came running back with my report, said to me, "Why do you always get 3s? So I said, "Well, you see, I am very constant." They did not press me unduly. They made certain that I had to do my homework after lunch and there was before I go out to play. But I was interested in too many things in life, and study did not preoccupy me. So whenever I was slightly in sort of trouble, I used to walk over to Pinchevsky family and ask Nadja, "What do you do about this?" And she would tell me very quickly. As it happens, she and her two sisters and I were the only survivors from the community. They now live in Australia. And 2 years ago, she, Nadja, came with her husband from Israel via London, and we met up after so many years.
So how many people out of 800, you say?
Yes, 4 of us survived. Everybody was murdered. So, coming back to the families, apart from the Czerzewskis, who were corn dealers, Pinchevsky, who were ironmongers, us, who were timber merchants, then you had the baker, and then you had some merchants. The rest of the community was poor or very poor, to such an extent that the rabbi organized a special committee to assist them, because there was no social security for poor people. So certain families used to knock on the door on Friday before Shabbat started, and there was a proper sort of little basket which was prepared and handed to them. The basket contained some baked challah for Shabbat, various other sort of goodies, and sometimes a little bit of money. And my grandfather and my mother and my father always made certain that when I go and hand over the basket to these people, I should make them feel that we are doing them a favor, not vice versa. So I remember vividly an elderly lady used to come to the door. She had a squint. I never knew where to look when I looked at her, whether to look at the right eye or left eye or in the middle of the eyes. And she would say in Yiddish, "Thank you very much, little Reuven. Thank you." Because that's in synagogue, I was called that. So I said, "Not at all, Mrs. So-and-so. Thank you." So she said, "Why do you thank me each time?" So I said, "Because you are doing us a favor by coming to collect this." So she used to pinch me on the cheek and that was called in Yiddish kuchi kuchi, a sort of a little, and say, oh, a bucher is a sort of young student, a Talmudic scholar. And she said, oh, you are a lovely bucher. That was, the Yiddish expressions carry many lovely sort of things. It was very tough for these people because we, who were one of the better off or one of the best off, had a bog outside. And during the winter, we had a sort of cabinet behind the stairs. And then we had to, this had to be emptied outside. Otherwise, one had to run out to the wooden toilet outside. None of the people in our town had a bathroom. We had sort of metal basins. The water was heated in a cauldron. And we were very fortunate because we dealt in coal and timber, so we had firewood. Some people didn't have firewood. And so this water was heated, and my brothers and sisters separately used to stand in that, and like you see certain prints in Japan, pour with the water over themselves and wash themselves like that and dry themselves. I had a wooden tub which was used for laundry washing, and that was placed on a table, and my mother used to put me in, and I was scrubbed in that. The other people who didn't have baths or hot water used to go to the ritual bath. And the ritual bath was warmed on Thursday and Friday mornings. One session for women, one session for men. And that was looked after and attended to by the beadle, equivalent to a beadle. In Yiddish, he's called a shamis. And he was also the scholar who read the Torah on Saturday. But in order to earn enough money to support his family, he did the dual job. When I went with my parents, with my father and my grandfather, to the ritual bath, what's called the mikvah, he was given the coin, like a tip, before entering, and sometimes he received more than the usual amount. We undressed there in that place. We were scrubbed by him, and some of the men were beaten by twigs, and that was a sort of extra treat for which he received a little bit more. But the little bit more was a question of pennies, really. It was so little, very little. And then, after being washed again over the head in these tubs, they were allowed to go downstairs and submerge themselves in that ritual bath. But the ritual baths had to be kept clean, so no one was allowed simply to go down. He either washed himself or was washed by this beadle, by this shamis, and inspected after the washing that it's clean enough to go downstairs. And the water was very hot, and everybody who went down submerged three times in that steaming water and then came out. And after this, some people put cold water over themselves, and then they sang songs, and because of the metal drum which held the water for the ritual baths down below, like a well, the acoustics were wonderful, and they used to sing, and then they started telling dirty jokes, and I had to be removed to the front, and I was so sorry that I couldn't participate with all the grown-ups in hearing these ditties which were not clean, and also these various jokes which were cracked. And I thought to myself, one day when I am 13 and I'm bar mitzvah, I'll tell my father that I'm old enough to stay there in order to listen to all these jokes. All I heard was the muffled sound of laughter and sounds coming through the sort of the walls. And there I waited for my parents to come out, and we walked home bundled up after this.
What was the significance of a ritual bath? Was it cleansing?
Yes, to clean yourself before Shabbat. So at least once a week, everybody was clean, and that applied to women too. And there was something about when they had their menstruation, their period, they were not allowed to use that. But I'm not particularly informed about this matter. This is more sort of thing which apply to the Talmudic scholars, but I'm sure that one could find this out easily. On Friday, one took the sholet to the baker. Sholet was a big pot which was closed like a pressure cooker, but there were no pressure cooker, so the lid was wrapped up with various rags, and in that, inside, there were potatoes, barley, beans, and meat. Usually brisket meat was considered the best. And then within that there was another pot set in with carrots and raisins, sultanas, and apples sometimes cut in, and that was the dessert. And that was all sealed up, and on the pot the instructions were given whether it should be put in the middle or on the right-hand side or left-hand side. Every woman knew which is the hot part of the baker's oven. And the youngest children used to take that. And during the winter, my sleigh was adapted with sort of guards on the side where I pulled that pot to the baker. And in addition to the instruction, I would have to poke him and say, make sure it's on the left-hand side and not far from the end, and so on. Because when it was in the middle and it boiled up, it was too burned. It was a very heavy meal on Saturday when everybody came from Shabbat. This thing had to be collected, and we all ate. It was so heavy that after the meal, everybody disappeared for a siesta. You had to find a corner of your bed and just quietly snooze for 2 hours in order to regain consciousness after this heavy meal. But we thought it delicious, and because the winters were so cold during the winters, that sort of meal really was wonderful, because first it was so heavy and it marred the hunger. And so poor people put very little meat. Other people who had that meat got more meat. The Jewish butcher knew that the briskets in rota goes to so-and-so and so-and-so. And the poor people used to get these shank bones, other things. But they didn't consider themselves poor because they led a dignified life. The majority of the Jews really were traders, because I don't know till when it existed that poor Jews could not own land. It just came about, I think, in end of 20s. So Jews had to exist with all the pogroms that were in the East by trading. And it was a custom that if somebody managed to acquire a little bit of money, he bought rings. So if he had to move during a pogrom, he took the fur coat and the rings and quickly disappeared before he could be murdered. And this custom existed that during certain marriages or certain festivals, the ladies were the precious thing, plus the things which they wore on themselves. And this goes right back to the Bedouins. A Bedouin will walk in front, and the wife will walk behind him, and she will have all the jewelry on her that he could afford. So she carries the treasures behind him. Sometimes he makes a walk in front in order to protect the treasures. So she and the treasures are the riches which he possesses. So for certain sort of convenient things, Jews invested in certain things which are permanent and something which they could trade when they reached another village, another town, in order to set themselves up.
Was there any history of pogroms in your village and your family?
Not that I know of, not when I was born, no. But there was the histories of pogrom is well documented both in Poland and in the Pale between Poland and Russia. I do remember my mother saying that when, after the First World War, Piłsudski wanted to establish the borders of Poland, the Russian Cossacks came and started plundering. And her brother, who eventually went, this Talmudic scholar who went to Palestine, was hidden by his sister because they used to either beat them up, Jews with beard, or if not, cut the beard off, by which they could also cut skins of people, or sometimes just murder people. So these sort of minor pogroms during this upheaval when Poland was a buffer state, invaded from this side or that side, the Jews were always the ones who suffered most. And one sees in the encyclopedia of Jewish life in the east of Europe, families standing there with bandaged heads, with broken arms, all sort of beaten up. But it happened for so many years that there was no redress. It was something which one had to work out a way of mitigating, but one could never overcome this. There was no redress, really, because either they were exploited by the landlords, or they were exploited by the Tsar hierarchy. Everybody found they were fair game for anything. So these poor people who subsisted on receiving their food and various handouts from other families lived a life, an existence of great impoverishment. And also it was a time that a bus from Chodecz left, one bus in the morning going to Włocławek and came back in the evening. Otherwise, the transport was simply by horse and cart. My father, when he fell out with his brother in Izbica Kujawska, sent the big logs when he bought certain parts of forest and had the wood cut down to a place very near Włocławek. And we had a horse, a very good horse, and a man who looked after this horse, who came to work for my father in 1926, year before I was born. And he would get up very early in the morning, 4 o'clock, and take the logs to be cut in a big sawmill very near Włocławek. And during holidays, I was allowed to go with him as a sort of adventure. And he would stop halfway and buy himself in a factory. There was a meat factory, a piece of sausage. And he would give me a piece and say, I won't tell you, father or grandfather, because this is not kosher. And I loved it. I never, of course, told them. And I thought it was wonderful. To such an extent that later on, when I was given money to buy myself these children magazines, I used to keep a little bit and go to a Polish butcher to the back door and say, could I buy a piece of sausage? And he would say, one day you'll be punished in heaven for eating this trifle thing. And of course, Mr. Gevis, who really was a German, he was a Catholic. And when Germans came, he remained a Pole, rather joining the Germans. The people in our town had very nice relationship with one another. What was spoiled was really that the screeching from across the border from Germany infected them. So although some of them heard the preaching of a priest who preached that we were the killers of Christ, many of them didn't take much notice of it and led their own life and life of tolerance, to such an extent that there was a man called Mr. Hoffman, who was a Polish Protestant, a German. He was a coffin maker and a joiner and a highly intelligent person. And he used to come to buy timber from my father. And when he purchased the timber, they used to play chess together. And Mr. Hoffman sometimes stood in the market advertising his coffin. And when he saw some of the people coming from the country, he would say, "You ought to invest in your afterlife. I'll make you a beautiful old coffin." And next week he would put a plaque in the window with this man's name. And some of them used to come, when they came to the market, used to give him on account. So they had their coffin ready before they died. So they took it away with them and could keep it for 10, 15 years. And they were very proud of it. When they died, they would have this wonderful coffin. And Mr. Hoffman, who spoke German, read Polish, most probably Russian too, was astute enough to make a fairly good living. And he had a wife and a daughter, and the daughter went to the same class as my sister, who was 6 years my junior. My father was married twice. He had five children with his first wife, and she died in childbirth in 1920. And then, through matchmaking, he married my mother, who was 20 years younger. And my mother was much more modern than my father. When she married him, he had a beard, but she said, "Have just a little bristle, that would be enough." And eventually, when I was born, he just had a bristle. And so when I got the photographs from my aunt and my family standing there together, my father just has a bristle, no longer a beard. And later on, he shaved much closer even. So my mother modernized him, although he remained Orthodox and attended the synagogue, and we had to keep kosher. All this was so. The uncle that I told you about was a barber, but he hated being a barber, and he was intellectual enough to do something else. So with the help from my father, he started a little grocery shop. And he was immaculately clean. Sometimes I came and stayed with my cousin, his house, and his house consisted of two rooms. And this little tiny shop, the shop was not much bigger than this room, perhaps a little bigger, sort of, I would say about 7 feet by 7 feet. And he read a lot, and he was very much interested in communism. Because above his bed, there was a very bad plaster cast of Karl Marx. And then this became quite dangerous to have. So he took this down, only put it up when for sale. We took no notice about that. But my brother, who was from my first wife, he was the fifth one down. When his mother died in childbirth, he could not get to university. There was numerous clauses for Jewish people. So he went to the library to read, and he really lied to my father because he said he's reading about how to mend watches because he wants to become a watchmaker. But in fact, he read Marx. And in 1937, he was just 17 when he went to Włocławek and carried the red flag in the parade, and the Polish police whisked him off and sent him to the one and only concentration camp that existed in Poland for political prisoner, communists, and that was Brzeza Kartuska. And my father then had to collect signatures saying that he's only a lad of 17, that he didn't know very much about it, that he was stoked into it, that he's really innocent, and collected about something over 1,000 signatures. I don't know how many he actually did. But my brother, over a year, after a year in Brzeza Kartuska, was let out. When he was still there, my mother made him sort of a quilted suit, trousers and thing. Because the letters which arrived, which were censors, we realized that all he had was a blanket at night, and there were marshes, and the work which they had was were dreadful. And when he came out, my father said to him, "You must promise me that you will never follow this communist ideology." So he promised. And my father sent him to be a supervisor of wood, which was cut down in a forest. And every day he wrote us letters, and these letters were read on Friday night, and he wrote beautifully. And he wrote about nature, about wild boars in this forest, about birds. And my father sent him books. And each time he wrote to him, he said, "You must remember, must stick to the promise, because otherwise you will be in great trouble, and so we will be." And my grandfather, my mother's father, who was my friend, was very wise. And before he was sent to the forest, he sort of took him aside and told him, and I listened to it, and he said to him, "You say that ends justify the means, but this is wrong. You cannot murder people, kill them, in order to achieve some illusion, because life is a process." And I puzzled over it, and I thought, what a sort of extraordinary thing. But my brother,